Today we're continuing a series of sermons we're currently doing in the book of Philippians. So if you have a Bible, go ahead and turn there with me. If not, there should be one under your chair or the chair next to you. And if you're using the Bibles under your chair or the chair next to you, that'll be on page 980 in those Bibles. And it'll help you to just follow along during this because we always want to make sure that the things we're saying on Sunday mornings come from God and what He has said, not just me and my ideas. I'm not a very creative guy, and why would you come just to hear what I think about stuff? We want to be rooted in what God has actually said. So we would love for you to follow along with us as we're going through this today. Be on page 980 in the Bibles, Philippians chapter 1. To give you a little background on me, I was born and raised in central Pennsylvania, and in 1994, I was 7 years old, and I started to make a scrapbook of newspaper clippings of Penn State football's undefeated season in 1994. About 2 years later, when I was 9 years old, I went to my first game, and I've been a fan ever since, including the years that I was in school there. And last year, my father-in-law treated me and my wife and a few of his other kids to tickets to the Penn State-Ohio State football game. Now, this was a night game, 8 p.m. on a Saturday night, and I knew I needed to be back here on Sunday morning to be a part of this service. And so I figured Ohio State's number 2 in the country, Penn State was unranked, we're going to get crushed, I'll leave at halftime, beat the traffic, and be back in time to get some sleep before the service starts. So we stayed till the third quarter, right? They kept me in. I thought, okay, but it was 21-7 at the end of the third, and I'm thinking, I've been here before, Penn State's going to lose this game, let's just leave. So me, my wife L'Oreal, and her cousin, who we were giving a ride to, all left. And as we're driving home, I flip the game on the radio, say, well, might as well see what happens. And sure enough, I hear that Penn State blocked a punt, they blocked a field goal, they came back, the fans all rushed the field, it was the biggest game in 10 years, and I missed the whole fourth quarter. So I'm sitting in my car, and I'm just, like, livid. Like, on the one hand, I'm happy that we won the game, kind of, but I'm just like, what have we done? You know? Not only that, I made her cousin miss it too, so I kind of like felt like I let him down on top of that. So for about an hour, I'm just sitting there talking about how bad of a decision that was and how miserable I am and how terrible this is. And L'Oreal's cousin said something to me that really helped me. He's been through some significant suffering in his life, and he said one thing that's really helped him, that time helped him to do, is to see that, like, missing the fourth quarter of football games in the grand scheme of things, fairly low, like, on the importance level. That was hard for me to hear in that moment, but when I let that sink in a little bit, it did give me an increased sense of peace and an increased sense of joy. A lot of our lack of joy in life comes because we're taking things that aren't that important and elevating them to a level of importance that they were never meant to have in our lives. Now, maybe with sports, it's easy to say, hey, look, it's just a game. It's not that big of a deal. But the challenge is there's a lot of things in our lives that drain our joy, and it's hard to convince ourselves that they're not that important, right? It's hard to just sit there and tell yourself, this doesn't matter that much, but it feels like it does. With those things, we need to replace them with something more important. They have to be driven out by a sense that we're living for something bigger than these individual things. As we come to the section of the book of Philippians we're in today, we're reading this book. It's written by a guy who's in prison and who has been stripped from a lot of the things that most of us would consider important. He's been stripped of his freedom and his comfort by being in a prison cell. He's been stripped of his reputation, we're going to see, and he's actually at risk of losing his life. And yet somehow we're going to see in this passage that he's rejoicing in the middle of all that. How is it possible to rejoice when so many of the things we would consider important are being taken away? I want to suggest to you today, on the basis of this passage, that if you want to have a joy that can exist in any circumstance in life, no matter what is being taken away from you, the only way to have it is to let go of our self-importance and to embrace the immeasurable importance of Jesus. So rejoice today. Jesus is more important than you. Now, I admit, even as I say that, it makes me a little uncomfortable, right? Because I can't imagine it would actually bring more joy to my life to think of myself as less important and to think of Jesus as more important. Like, it feels offensive, almost, to say that Jesus is more important than I am and that Jesus is more important than you are. But I want to suggest that that is actually better for your joy than anything else. And we're going to see that today because Jesus is better than your comfort, Jesus is better than your reputation. Jesus is better than your life, and Jesus is better than your death. More important than all those things, and true joy will come as we embrace it. So look with me, Philippians chapter 1. I'm going to start reading in verse 12. The chapters are the big numbers, the verses are the smaller ones. I'll read verse 12 through 26 out loud now. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me, yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. So first, we're going to see Jesus is more important than your comfort. So Paul begins verse 12 by telling us there's something he wants us to know. He says, I want you to know, brothers. And he's writing this from prison. And so the Philippians are probably, the original recipients of this letter are probably wondering a lot of things about him, right? If someone you knew and cared about was in prison, you'd want to know, how are they doing? So he's writing to them, and he's saying, here's what I want you to know about me. Because prison is a place where your freedoms and your comforts are significantly curtailed, right? Paul's vision for his life, like whatever plans he may have had for his future, his life, career, family, friends, now are all under the control of a foreign government, of a government that has imprisoned him. And it's no secret how he ended up there. He ended up there for just preaching the message of the gospel, for preaching the message of Christianity. And here's what's weird. In the middle of all that, he doesn't say, I want you to know, brothers, how hard it is. I want you to know how miserable I am. I want you to know the price I've paid for the gospel. What does he want them to know? He says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. Of all the things you could know about my imprisonment, here's the thing I really want you to be aware of. What's happening to me is actually making this gospel mission go forward. The gospel mission is not losing in the face of opposition, right? The guy who's the missionary, the main guy that we've sent out because he's in prison, that doesn't mean we're losing. What he's saying is the opposition of the gospel is not only not hindering it, it's actually furthering it. The gospel is advancing through my being put in prison here. There has never been a time in human history where Christians need to breathe into paper bags and fear because the gospel is being opposed. And it's easy to think that way, to think like, oh man, you know, the culture is so not Christian and the churches are empty and there's so much opposition and what are we going to do and where are we going to go? No, Paul says, in the midst of opposition, the gospel is advancing. And the gospel did advance through him. Like when he's writing this letter, Christianity is not a big thing. It's a fringe group. And yet somehow through him and through the other people who were following Jesus in this early stage, the gospel spread through the Roman Empire that was in power at this time. It started to spread so much that future emperors put their forces to work to oppose this movement and started just killing Christians as a way of stopping this movement. But again, the opposition didn't work. The opposition actually advanced the gospel, and the gospel grew even further to the point where it permeated the whole Roman Empire by the year 400. And now, 1,500 years later, the Roman Empire is a thing of the past. You can go to Rome today and see the ruins of the Roman Empire. But guess what else you can find in Rome today? You can find people worshiping Jesus today in Rome, 1,500 years later. This powerful empire that's imprisoning Paul seemed like it had everything Today, it's nothing. Today, it's reduced to ruins. And the gospel has spread not only in Rome, but to every major continent in the world. For fun the other day, I just did a search online to see churches in Rome. I went to this Redeemer City to City, which is a church planting network out of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York. They've got three churches in Rome. Their websites are all in Italian, so I couldn't tell you a thing about them. I guess they didn't know that I would be visiting their website this past week, so they didn't put it in English. But they're preaching the gospel in Rome today, in the ruins of the Roman Empire. The gospel advanced through Paul. It advanced to every major continent in the world. Today in the United States, even, evangelical Protestants, which we're a part of, are the only religious body converting more people than they're losing. Under Mao Zedong in the 1950s in China, missionaries were driven out in masses. And yet today, in China, there will be more Christians worshiping than in all of so-called Christian Europe. In East Asia, current projections are that by 2020, Christianity will have grown from 11.4 million Christians in 1970 and 1.2% of the population to 171 million Christians and 10.5% of the population. Today at City Light Church, just take us, between our two congregations, there are over 500 people worshiping Jesus today in a church that didn't exist 6 years ago. And that's all happening in the city of Philadelphia, in a city where the common statistic is that 9 out of 10 people are not in a worship gathering on Sunday mornings. And here's the beautiful thing. We're not even alone, right? Just go up Broad Street. Travel up Broad Street today. You'll find Epic Church worshiping. You'll find Greater Exodus Baptist Church worshiping. You'll find Epiphany Fellowship worshiping. Soma Philly just planted a church in Brewerytown. City Church just planted a church in Fairmount. It's popping up all over the place. We're not even alone. The gospel is advancing. The gospel has been advancing for the last 2,000 years. And what Paul is saying here is that even opposition, it won't succeed in stopping the gospel. It will actually be used by God to advance the gospel even further. Now, how can that be? Well, first, Paul says that it has become known in verse 13, it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all that his imprisonment is for Christ. So people are seeing this is a guy who's willing to be put in prison for the sake of the gospel. Now, how did they know that? Well, on the one hand, word maybe just gets around. But Paul's also not the kind of guy who, if you ask him, like, hey, so what are you in here for? He's going to tell you, right? Oh, funny you should ask. I'm in here for preaching the gospel. In fact, there's a story in the book of Acts where Paul is actually singing psalms and hymns in his jail cell in the middle of the night. You think people might get it, like why this guy is here? And so it's becoming clear to these guards that Paul is here for the sake of the gospel. Even in the middle of his imprisonment, what's he thinking about? What's he rejoicing in? He's seeing, wow, now I've got prison guards who I can tell about Jesus. I might not have met these guys if I hadn't have been thrown in prison. This is an incredible opportunity. And what are the guards seeing? The guards are seeing whatever this Jesus thing is, it must be really important. Because this guy's willing to lose all of his comfort just for speaking about it, right? That's all he's doing. He's out there proclaiming Jesus, going to prison, and he's saying, you know what? I'm going to keep doing it. In fact, if you put me in prison, I'm going to convert your jailers. I'm going to tell those guys about Jesus too. Now, not only does that show something to the non-believers, to the people who don't yet know Jesus in the prison, it shows something to the believers too. He says that, right? He says that through this, in verse 14, that most of the brothers have become confident in the Lord by his imprisonment and are now much more bold to speak the word without fear. They're seeing it can be done, right? You can be opposed. You can have your comfort and your freedom taken away and just keep preaching the gospel. It's possible. And yet, it's most of the brothers, right? He's not saying there was an expert class of Christians who gained a lot of Bible knowledge and then learned to tell everyone about Jesus. Brothers is a catch-all term for Christians. And he's saying normal, everyday Christians, through his imprisonment, became bold in Jesus to speak the word without fear. Because let's face it, for most of us, a lack of information is not the problem. A lack of confidence in the Lord is the problem. Fear is the reason that we don't speak the word. Sure, if you go speak the gospel and talk about Jesus and go public with your faith in Christ to people around you, they may ask you questions that you don't know the answer to. That's fine. God can advance the gospel through those things too. Just say, I don't know, but I would love to find out. And go ask your city group leader or come ask me. And if we don't know the answer, we can help you find the answer. God uses these things, but the thing that's missing a lot of times is this confidence in the Lord, this confidence that God can really use me. And let's face it, like, we give opinions all the time on stuff we're not experts on. It doesn't stop us in most of life, right? Like, how many of you who have thrown up some opinion on politics on Facebook are policy experts, right? We have no problem speaking the word without fear when it comes to our political views. How many of us who criticize head coaches, general managers, quarterbacks, have actually a level of training that's even comparable to these things that these experts have, right? But we still feel like we can tell them they're wrong. If you have the boldness and you can risk relationships with people and get people genuinely angry at you in order to share your political views with them, but you can't talk to people about Jesus, what does that say about what you love? Like, if you can spout off on Facebook and on social media about the things you think about a certain political candidate or about your views, but you haven't talked to anyone about Jesus over the past year, what does that say about what's most important, what the thing you're willing to risk relationships over is? The big question you've got to deal with isn't the question you're afraid your friends are going to ask you. The question you've got to deal with is Jesus really of utmost importance in your life? And do you believe that God can use you? The God who can use imprisonment, right? The God who can advance the gospel through opposition is certainly capable of using you, even with your lack of knowledge, even with whatever spiritual immaturity is still remaining in you. If God didn't use imperfect people, he wouldn't use any of us, right? But God is a God who advances the gospel through all kinds of difficult things. And there's just something more important, right? Paul's saying there's something, I'm losing my comfort and my freedom, but there's something that matters more. And it's the advance of the gospel. And it matters more than my comfort and freedom, and it matters more than your comfort and your freedom. At the same time that brothers in Christ are gaining this new confidence, Paul's also facing some opposition from people even preaching the gospel, right? He goes on to talk about in verse 15 that some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. He's saying there's other people out there who are preaching the gospel, but they're doing it to afflict me, he says, to make my imprisonment worse than it is. So probably what's happening is they're preaching the gospel, but they're also kind of dissing Paul at the same time. They're saying, this guy's in prison, and you know why he's in prison? It's because he's not really advancing the gospel. It's because he's not really for you. And so not only is Jesus more important than his comfort, Jesus is more important than his reputation, right? His reputation is being threatened by these false teachers. And yet, these teachers are preaching the gospel, actually. That's why he can say, I can still rejoice, right? That's what he says in verse 18. Whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Now, he could just shrink back. He could just say, you know what, I'm going to get out of this whole business. I'm tired of people messing with my reputation. But he says, no, as long as they're preaching Jesus, whatever. As long as Christ is proclaimed, I can rejoice because Jesus is more important than my reputation. His reputation is under fire, and yet he continues rejoicing. Now, for many of us who are Christians in America today, for those of you in the room who are Christians, my guess is your fear is probably more about your reputation than it is about being thrown in prison for preaching the gospel. There are times where perhaps you hear Christian sex ethics being made fun of. They kind of become the punchline in your favorite stand-up comedian's latest routine. There are times where perhaps you've had professors who have made kind of someone who takes the Bible seriously sound like an idiot and someone not worthy of honest dialogue. There are times when mass media can present evangelical Christians in particular as in the worst possible light. I'm not saying woe is me and we have it so bad here in America, but that kind of stuff sinks in, right? Like, you hear that stuff and some part of you, inside of you, if you just take that in passively, is saying, well, I don't want to be the punchline to anyone's joke. I don't want to be the one who's getting the kind of talk that I hear my coworkers giving to a lot of Christians that they talk about. What Paul's saying here is, I've become the punchline, right? I'm the guy who people are throwing stones at, and he's rejoicing. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine if your comfort and your reputation took a back seat to the point where you could actually be the kind of person who could rejoice even when they're under fire? The problem, if those things are the most important things in your life, is that you will only have joy as long as they're good. As long as your situation's good, as long as people like you, you'll be happy. But that is such a fragile happiness. That can be taken away from you in a moment by forces that you're totally out of control of. What we're seeing here is the opportunity to have a joy rooted in something far more stable. The only way to have lasting joy is if you tie it to something that can be advanced in any situation. Something that even when other things are taken away can still move forward. And that's what the gospel is. It is something that can advance through imprisonment. It is something that can advance even when your reputation is taken away. And if that becomes the most important thing in your life, if Jesus and his honor becomes the thing at the center, then you can say, yes, I'm losing all this stuff, but as long as that's going forward, I'm happy, I'm rejoicing, even in the middle of genuine hardship. So take that kind of perspective when challenges come into your life. Like, really stop and think and ask the Lord, how is the gospel being advanced in this situation? How do you want the gospel to be advanced in this situation? And it often starts with the people right around you. Like, Paul's in prison, and who's he thinking about? The guards, right? Because they're the people he's around. He's like, okay, these are the people, God, that you've placed me around. I'll start by just telling them about Jesus. Some of you know that I've recently kind of had some struggles with depression, and I've been talking with other people in the church who struggle with depression and other forms of mental illness, many in ways more significant than I do. And one thing I've learned in those conversations, in the midst of all the hardship that's been a comfort to people consistently, not a cure, not something that just fixes it right away, but a comfort in the midst of it, is how God's been able to use them to comfort others who are struggling in similar ways. Like, I'm hearing people say that they're seeing how God is using this to advance the gospel through them in the lives of other people. And that's cause for rejoicing, right? If you can do that, if you can look at your hard circumstances and you can see how the gospel is advancing, there's opportunity for rejoicing, even in the middle of hardship. And I'm not saying that's easy, right? I'm not saying that to be trite, like, hey, buck up, you know, the gospel's advancing. No, it's hard, it sucks. And yet it's not the full story, right? The thing Paul wants us to know in this situation is that the gospel is advancing, even in the midst of his reputation, even when he's being threatened. As long as Christ is proclaimed, he says, in that I can rejoice. And you can rejoice in that too. That is possible by the grace of God to have rejoicing even in the midst of real hardship if you see the way the gospel is advancing. And not only is it possible now, he goes on in verse 18 to say, yes, and I will rejoice. When he looks into the future, he can make this confident prediction. Looking ahead, this is what I know about my future. I will rejoice in the future. I will have joy then. Now, how can he say that, right? It's because Jesus is also more important than his life or his death. So sitting in prison, when Paul looks into the future, he knows there's two basic possibilities, right? He's kind of beyond the point of peaceful release because he's going to keep preaching the gospel. So usually if they put you in prison for a crime and you just keep doing it, that's not going to end well for you, right? So he knows either they're just going to keep me in here and I'm going to rot here, maybe I can be freed somehow by God's grace, or they're just going to kill me. And yet looking into his future, he says, I'm going to rejoice. Why? Because he knows that even if death comes his way, Christ will be honored. Keep reading here, look. He says in verse 20, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. He's saying there's a way for Christ to be honored even if I die. And what is that? Well, he tells us a little bit later in the passage that his desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. He's basically saying, if I die, I will get to depart and be with Christ. I will get to see Jesus face to face. That was his expectation. And he's saying, that would be far better than actually anything that I can possibly get on earth. The condition that Paul is referring to is what theologians call the intermediate state. The doctrine of the intermediate state teaches that when believers die, that there's a temporary separation between our souls and our bodies. And our bodies, while buried or cremated or whatever happens to our bodies, our souls go to be in the presence of Jesus at that time. And it's called the intermediate state because that's not permanent. When Jesus returns, Jesus will resurrect our dead bodies and reunite them with our souls to live with him forever. And this is all possible because Jesus himself died in our place and rose from the dead. Because Jesus really rose, that's not just wishful thinking. If Jesus really came out of the grave, this life after death that Paul is looking forward to is not only possible, it's promised to all those who have trusted in Jesus. And when Paul looks ahead to that state, to departing to be with Christ, he says that is far better. And he says it is his desire. Now, it's hard to overstate how crazy what he's saying here is. The word he uses for desire is a word that's also translated as lust or covetousness or passion throughout the New Testament. It's not generally a positive word. It's usually like an inordinate lust, a desire for something that's become controlling and kind of weird and too strong. And he's saying, my lust is to depart and be with Christ. Can you imagine that? Think of all the things that we lust after, right? The things that catch us up and catch us in their grips. And he's saying, Jesus has become so important to me, so beautiful to me, that the thing I'm tempted by, my temptation that I struggle with, is to depart and be with Christ, is to be face to face with him. That's how amazing he's. What if your temptation in life was not sexual immorality, but to depart and be with Jesus? That's the thing that was just grabbing you. What if your temptation in life was not to covet your neighbor's stuff or your neighbor's life or to daydream about the ideal American dream future of your life, but to depart and be with Christ? And he says that would be, the reason he does that is because it would be far better. And again, he's overstating it, right? He's purposely, in Greek, he uses three words for far better. We just don't, it'd be weird to translate that into English, but he basically says much, far, greater, better. He's saying, I can't think of enough words to tell you how much better it would be to depart and be with Jesus than to be here on earth. He's saying there's nothing on earth that even compares to what that would be like. Marriage, great kids, a great retirement, an ideal career, no financial stress, vacation home, none of it. Jesus, far better to depart and be with him. God, make me like that. I mean, that's not what naturally comes out of me, right? And yet, we see that it's possible. And it's especially hard, I think, when you're younger to feel that way. Sometimes you even think, like, well, I don't want to depart and be with Jesus yet. I've got so much I want to do with my life, right? And yet what he's saying is, whatever that is, it's not as good as Jesus. Like, to depart and be with him would just be far better. And I think as you get a little older, you start to realize some of that. I'm really getting up there. I'm going to be 30 in a couple months, so got a lot of wisdom I'm going to drop on you youngins here. But I have gotten to experience at least some things that, like, 10 years ago, I would have thought that's really going to be amazing. Like, I'm married, for example. I've been married for 4 years. And if you know my wife, you know, like, I married up in a significant way. And I don't just say that, like, that's cute, you know, but really, like, the constancy of her character, her love for Jesus, the strength of her faith, like, it puts me to shame. And she's not Jesus, though. And marriage is great. And yet to depart and be with Christ would be far better. And it's easier for me to believe that now on the other side of marriage. Single people are like, no, you know, a relationship would be ultimate. It wouldn't be, right? It's going to be hard. The person's not going to be Jesus. Job. I love the job I do right now, right? I get to be the pastor of an awesome church in a northeastern city. This is something I aspired to years ago, right? Like, I wanted to be in the role that I'm in today. This isn't a stepping stone for me to something greater. You guys make it an awesome church to pastor. Like, the kinds of volunteers we have, the people that make this church, City Light Church, it's just, thank you. Like, I thank God for you all, and I thank God for the chance to be a pastor here and a pastor of you all in particular. For your friendships, for the relationships, for the constancy. And yet you're not Jesus. It's still, to depart and be with him would be far better. And to depart and be with him will be far better than anything you can possibly have on earth. It just will be. Now, if that's the case, if to die is gain, as verse 21 puts it, to die is gain. We're going to get into that verse next week. That's why I'm kind of glossing over it right now, but we're going to focus there next week. But he says, to die is gain. If that's the case, we should want to die, right? Well, Paul admits that there's a tension here, right? He says, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, and yet he knows, if I remain in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. So what he's saying is, even though my immediate desire is to depart and be with Christ, Jesus is also more important than that. He's more important than my death. There's work still to be done here. And therefore, he says, he ends up being convinced that he will remain on earth. So in verse 25, he says that. He says, being confident of this, I will remain with you. Now, why? Why will he remain on earth? So he can cross off his bucket list, right? So he can live life to the fullest, you know, YOLO, Paul. Doing it up. I'm not going to die yet. I got vacations to take, man. I've got trips to go on. I've got experiences still to have. Well, kind of, that's what he's saying. But look at his bucket list, right? Look at what's on there. Look at verse 25. He says, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith. That's why he's staying on earth. He says, I know to depart and be with Jesus would be far better, but if I departed to be with Jesus right now, I couldn't be used by him for your progress and joy in the faith. I wouldn't be here to write this letter to you, and his expectation that he'll actually be able to come to them, that God will get him out of this prison and send him back to the Philippians so that he can love them for their progress and their joy in the gospel. It's fruitful labor that's keeping him on earth. Because the joy he has in Jesus is so good, he doesn't want to die unless other people can experience it too. This past week, it so happened that Tuesday was Fasnacht Tuesday, or Fat Tuesday. And those of you who know me know I'm something of a donut fan. And so it's a fun week for me because on Tuesday, the donut finally gets the glory that it deserves, and we all get to enjoy it. So, of course, I took some time out of my day to walk down to Reading Terminal Market and hit Byler's Donuts. And I waited in the line for 10 minutes like you normally have to. Totally worth it, but I did it. And so I got my donuts, and what did I want to do right away? I wanted to eat one of them, right? Like right then. But I had my Citigroup gathering that night, and so I bought them so that I could share them with my Citigroup. I love these donuts so much that I want other people to experience the joy with me as well. And I know if I eat them all today, they're not going to get to. That's something like what Paul is saying here, except it's way better, right? He's saying, I would love to just depart and be with Jesus right now, but I so love him that I wouldn't want to go unless others could experience it with me. So I'll stay. So I'll be here and I'll stay in this prison, and I will get out, and I will come to you for your progress and your joy in the gospel. And sometimes it is just tempting to want to depart and be with Jesus, right? If you really believe that. Because life is hard. Life is hard. People are hard. Your job is hard. Your marriage can be hard. Like a lot of stuff in your life can pile up. And you can say, I just don't want to deal with any of this. And you can have days where you don't even feel like you can get out of bed, because life is pressing in on you and you just want to depart and be anywhere but there. And in some sense, it's right and reasonable to say and to long for and to hunger for the day when that's all gone, when you can just be with Jesus, when you will have rest in his presence. God made you for that, and you're not home yet, and you should long for and desire the home that Jesus is bringing for you. And yet, if it's Jesus' purpose for you still to be here, then it's Jesus' purpose. Right? He still has purpose for your life today if you are still here. There are ways that God wants to use you. There is fruitful labor that God has for you. There are good works that God has set out in advance for you. If you are here today, that's true of you, right? There's a reason that he hasn't let you yet depart and to be with Christ, even though that would be far better. He has fruitful labor for you to do here today, even when you feel totally powerless. Even when you feel like you can't do it, even when you feel like you got nothing in you, Jesus has purpose for your life. He has something, a way that he wants to use you to advance the gospel. And it looks different. It looks different for each person. We each have our own individual assignments from God, but our purpose is the same, that whether it by life or by death, Christ would be honored. And whatever we do, that the gospel would advance. For some of you this week, it's going to look like writing a computer program. For some of you, it's going to look like caring for a sick friend or family member or patient that you're paid to care for. It's going to look like washing a dish. It's going to look like changing a diaper. It's going to look like blessing someone in your city group, encouraging a coworker. Whatever God has assigned you this week, he has purpose in it. And doing all of that with a kind of gospel intentionality, asking the question of, God, how do you want to use the things you have given me this week to advance the gospel so that Christ would be honored through everything I do, and taking advantage of the opportunities God brings before you to speak the word without fear, to have confidence in him that he has purpose for you this week and he actually wants to use you. Whatever you feel, this much is true. God has purpose for your life, and it's a purpose that he can advance, that he is powerful to advance, right? Paul's not saying they put me in prison and I did it. He's saying they put me in prison and the gospel advanced. God did it. God used me, even in these hard circumstances, and God can use you. Now, here's the problem. That'll never really be good news to us. That'll never really bring rejoicing, as long as the things in our life are still more important than Jesus. If I tell you it's okay, the gospel's advancing, but you don't really love the gospel that much, that's not that good of news. That's just buck up and feel better. So how did Paul get to this place where he could say, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better? How can we get to that place? Well, he hadn't already departed and been with Christ, right? So he can't say, I've already been there and I know it's far better. But here's what he did know. He knew Jesus. And he knew, Paul, that he was the worst sinner he ever knew. I'm the worst sinner I know. Me, Mike. And yet, Jesus came into the world to save sinners. He knows that Christ is the one, the God, who left the comfort and the freedom of heaven to take on imprisonment himself, to be confined to a body. And on earth, Jesus received not only the sentence of imprisonment, he received the sentence of death. Jesus is the one who left his comfort. He's saying Jesus is the one who laid down his reputation, right? He was God. That's like the best reputation you can possibly have. Creator of the universe. Lord over everything. There's no name higher than that name, as we're even going to see later in the book of Philippians. And yet these are some of the names that Jesus took on when he was on earth. Man of sorrows. As one from whom men hid their faces. Who was esteemed not. Who came to his own, and his own did not even receive him. That's the reputation that Jesus took on, though he was God, though he was Lord of lords and King of kings. Jesus was already in heaven, enjoying communion with his heavenly Father, and he departed, right? See, for Paul, to depart from earth means going to the better thing. Jesus had the better thing, and he departed to come to earth, to come to the lesser thing. To do what? To die. To be hung on a cross for you and for me, so that we could depart and be with Christ, so that we could have the thing that is far better, that though we die, we could live because he died and because he lived. For Paul, he thought death was a possibility, but here's the deal. He knows he's going to die someday anyway. Jesus never had to die. He was God, and yet he came to earth and took on a body subject to death and died in the worst possible way. Why'd he do it? He did it so that we could experience him, so that we could depart and be with him and experience his glory. And he tells us that. In John 17, verse 24, he's praying just before he goes to die on the cross. This is what he says. Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, that's us, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am. Saying, I want them to be able to depart and be with me, to see my glory that you have given me, because you loved me before the foundation of the world. Now, what could be better? What could be better than that? What's more important? Comfort, reputation, your life, your death, none of it compares to this Jesus, right? As long as his gospel is advanced, as long as he is honored, do you really need anything else? Ultimately, right? I get it. Like, you need a place to sleep, you need to eat, okay. But ultimately, if his gospel is advanced, if he is made much of, if he is honored, you don't have to make your life work. And you don't have to wait to have joy until all this stuff in your life that you're not in control of magically comes to fruition. You can rejoice today. Rejoice today, because Jesus is more important than you.